Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Our program today is speaking with Tom Hartman on his newest book, The Hidden History of American Democracy, Rediscovering Humanity's Ancient Way of Living. In his latest book in the Hidden History series, Tom Hartman writes a powerful sweeping history and analysis of American democracy. He shows how democracy is the one form of government most likely to produce peace and happiness among people. Now our democracy is under targeted threat. How do we save our country from those who think we have too much democracy? We have big things to do. Now, our guest today is that very Tom Hartman. However, our program engineer is still trying to reach him on the phone. So I'm going to continue introducing him and hoping he'll be patched in. So Tom Hartman is a national and international syndicated progressive talk show host. His program is called The Tom Hartman Program. Talkers Magazine named him America's number one most important progressive radio host. He is a four-time recipient of the Project Censored Award, and he is also a New York Times bestselling author of more than 30 books that have been translated into multiple languages. His social media sites are tomhartman.com, thehartmanreport.com, or you may reach him on Twitter at tom_Hartman, HARTMANN. Since we only have Tom for the first half hour of our program, I've invited Andrew Goldenkrantz, chair of the Santa Cruz County Democratic Party, to finish out the hour with me, and he is also online. Hello, Tom. It is such a delight to have you on the show. Welcome back to Be Bold America. Are you there?
Well, thank you. I am. Sorry about the noise in the background. I'm driving, but I just didn't make it down to my calendar.
No.
All is good. I'm here.
All is good. You're here. We love you, and we're delighted that you could squeak in half hour here in your car.
My pleasure.
I also want to say hello to Andrew now, too. Hello, Andrew. Thank you for joining us from your vacation in Tahoe.
Hello, Jill. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm delighted that you could join me. Yes, Tom, meet Andrew. Andrew, meet Tom.
Yeah, hey.
Good to meet you.
Tom, since we only have you for the first half hour of the show, why not begin with some of that most exciting, fascinating, and key information you chose to include in the Hidden History of American Democracy? Can we really ever have too much democracy?
No, democracy is actually embedded in our DNA. It was one of the most fascinating things I discovered when I was researching the book. About a decade ago, two scientists in the UK, Ken Conrad and Dr. Roper, I'm forgetting the last name, hypothesized that all animals would, in all social animals, which is 99% of all animals, would engage in democracy as their primary decision-making process, which flies in the face of our popular mythology, which is that, you know, species have alpha animals and the alpha animals make the decisions. They postulated that the alpha animals would have first choice of sexual partner, consistent with Darwinian, you know, pass along the strongest genes, but outside of that would not have decision-making power when it came to the overall community. And this has now been verified in multiple studies. The most fascinating, right after they published that, was about a year later. It was done by some scientists who published this in New Scientist. James Randerson was the guy. And they had a herd of red deer living in a forest near the University of Essex in the UK. And so they put, you know, cameras in the trees to watch the deer and see how they decided, like, when to go to the water hole. You know, there were three different water holes in the area. How do they know which one to go to, and how do they know when to go? These are consequential decisions. If they wait too long, some animals will become dehydrated. If they go too soon, some animals won't get the right amount of nutrients. And what they found was that the animals would just kind of randomly start pointing their bodies at different, the three different water holes. And when 50% plus one of the deer had pointed their heads toward one of the water holes, within about 2 minutes, all of the herd would assemble and go to that particular water hole. In our Constitution, we've got a higher threshold for really dangerous decisions, like amending the Constitution. It requires two-thirds of Congress. And so they tried, you know, let's up the stakes. They put a predator or a stuffed one, you know, with the proper smells and things, a stuffed wolf, near one of the watering holes. And what they found was that then, you know, once there was a predator in the vicinity, the deer would not make a decision until two-thirds of the deer were all pointing at the same watering hole, which is pretty incredible.
That's fascinating.
I called Ken Conrad, and I said, you know, what happened when you published this? Because it was published in Nature, which is a, you know, peer-reviewed journal. And he said it was amazing. He said the bug people were the first to call me. They said, you know, we're seeing the same thing with balls of gnats, you know, like you see in the air in the summer. And how do they know how to move? You know, well, it turns out that every wing beat is a vote. And when a particular gnat, you know, moves a quarter inch up or a quarter inch to the left or a few degrees to the right or whatever, when 51% of them have taken that position, the entire ball of gnats moves. And then a fish guy called, an ichthyologist, and said, yeah, we're seeing the same thing with fish. This accounts for schooling activity. I had always thought they were, like, telepathic or something, you know. And with birds, he had a bird guy call and say, yeah, we see this with flocks of birds. It's the exact same thing. Every wing beat is a vote. And when 51% vote for, you know, a three-degree move to the right, the whole flock moves 3 degrees to the right as they're migrating or flying or whatever. So this is the default in nature for all animals, including humans. And that's why I think, you know, when you look at some of the really in-depth anthropological works, like, for example, The Dawn of Everything, Graeber's new book, you know, that goes back and looks at how people lived 20, 30, 40,000 years ago, the vast majority of Aboriginal and Indigenous communities do this democratic decision-making, and that's actually where we got the idea for the United States, was from Native Americans, by and large.
Well, I had no idea that the Iroquois played such a vital role in our Constitution.
Yeah, it was substantial. You know, most people think that the popular mythology is that we got our Constitution and our ideas of democracy from, you know, Hobbes and Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Montesquieu and whatnot. And it turns out that back in the late 1600s, throughout the 1800s, there was a fad, as it were, it was a very popular thing in France to have the occult salons, which is mostly it was upper middle class and wealthy women, and invite people of note to their home, and then people would come from the intelligentsia and the upper classes of society and hang out there and see what's going on. And in the late 1600s, the French missionaries had made substantial inroads into a number of the Iroquois Confederacy tribes, particularly the Huron. And a lot of the Huron had learned how to speak French very competently. And so in the early and mid 1700s, a number of these Native Americans from the Hurons traveled to Europe at the request of the French missionaries, who had been publishing stories about, you know, these democratic societies in France for some time. And they would travel to France and participate in these salons. And Rousseau was in one, and Locke was in one. Like, these guys who got these ideas, the Enlightenment thinkers, the Enlightenment Europeans who got their ideas about democracy, got them from the Native Americans.
Oh, my.
And this was not a surprise, by the way, to people like Franklin and Jefferson and Adams, who all, you know, had lived with and worked with and known Native Americans for a long, long time. But it's fascinating first of all, it wasn't Greek and Roman, you know, the Greek democracy, you know, which failed after a short period of time, or the Roman Republic, which really was never a democracy. It was Native Americans. And you know, as you look across the world, you find that it wasn't just Native Americans. There were tribal people all over the world had figured out how to live democratically. We'd had 300,000 years of trial and error to figure this out. And it turns out that the dictatorial regimes are actually the minority. There was a fascinating piece. This isn't in my book. It was just published last week, but it was published in Nature, you know, the peer-reviewed journal. And they're doing some really great archaeological work in Mesoamerica and Central America. And what they found was hundreds of communities, many of them small, but some of them as large as several hundred thousand people, where there's literally no evidence of poverty and no evidence of great wealth, and no evidence of warfare. And, you know, what they found is that these were the societies that were more likely to survive invasion, they were more likely to survive drought, they were more likely to survive natural disasters. And they were, because they were more resilient, because they were small d democratic. It turns out that the reason that's in our genes, the reason that's part of the nature of all animals, is that it's the safest way to make decisions. There literally is wisdom in the crowds. You know, there's something to that. It's real.
Well, skipping a little bit into your book, but I think it's an important question. Again, because we feel rich white men are supposed to run the country, you explain the destructive myth that the United States was founded exclusively of, by, and for rich white men. Can you give us your thoughts on that, too?
Yeah, this is a meme that rich white men are very fond of.
<You know? laughs> I bet.
And in fact, it's not true at all. There were rich white men in the United States in the 1770s and 1780s. By and large, they took the side of the British, the very, very wealthy. The wealthiest of all the people who signed the Declaration of Independence was John Hancock. And his total assets, his total net worth in today's dollars, was around $700,000. He would have been upper middle class. A number of the other people who participated in that era, Jefferson died in bankruptcy, George Washington died in bankruptcy, or on the verge of it. James Madison, his family lost their house, within a generation. There were no dynastic families among the founders. There were some from that time. The Johnson family had a castle on the Rhine or on the Hudson River. But they fled to Canada during the Revolutionary War. Most of the really profoundly rich, and there were a few, and most of them were associated with the British East India Company, fled the country. So, number one, it was mostly what you might call upper middle class and middle class guys. Number two, Forrest MacDonald did this in-depth study in 1956. He wanted to see if James and Mary Beard in 1929 wrote The History of America, which was, one of the more popular history books of American history. Charles and Mary was a Marxist and Charles was a socialist, and they were professors at Columbia University. And they hypothesized that the Constitution was a document designed to perpetuate wealth in the United States. And so MacDonald went back to see, okay, who was in favor of and who was opposed to the Constitution. And what he found was that the majority of the people who, he went through the ratifying conventions for each one of the 13 states and looked at who attended and how they voted. And what he found was that the vast majority of people in state after state after state who voted for the Constitution were people who were in debt, small farmers, subsistence farmers, teachers, the kind of just the run-of-the-mill middle-class professions or the poor. And the people who were opposed to the Constitution, by and large, were the very wealthy. For example, Patrick Henry was opposed to the Constitution. He was the wealthiest slave owner in Virginia, one of the truly wealthy people. He had over 360 enslaved people. Give me liberty or give me death was his And he was the reason why James Madison, at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, he argued against the Constitution because he said that Article 1, Section 8, which gave the president the power to call up the state militias during time of crisis, he was afraid that that would allow a president to call up the Virginia State Militia, which was also the Virginia Slave Patrol. And so the first draft of the Second Amendment said for the security of a free nation. And James Madison, after telling Henry to his face that because they were both from Virginia, this was at their ratifying convention, that he thought that Henry was paranoid, went ahead and changed the word nation to the word state to make it clear that they were protecting the militia of Virginia, the slave patrol, from being called up, because Patrick Henry was, and he said so, he was quite concerned that some future president would do exactly what Abe Lincoln did, which is basically, try to destroy slavery in the South, by going after their militia.
This is a time to take a quick break. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM. Listen globally online at ksqd.org website. We're speaking with Tom Hartman, and our topic today is on his newest book, The Hidden History of American Democracy, Rediscovering Humanity's Ancient Way of Living. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Following our successful Signal expansion campaign, K-Squid welcomes our new listeners in Salinas, Watsonville, and Carmel, now at 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM. Make all of them a preset on your radio so you stay with the Squid wherever you go.
We're back, Tom. Did you know that KSQD Board of Directors raised over $400,000 recently and have purchased those two additional licenses?
That's very cool, Jill.
Isn't it cool? The station has now tripled its listening area. You know, as she said, Salinas, Prunedale, Carmel, Carmel Valley, Monterey, Pacific Grove, you know, Seaside, Marina, just expanded, tripled it. And I am so proud of this board for doing that work. It's very hard as for a nonprofit to raise that kind of money.
Yeah, it really is. That's marvelous.
Isn't it? Andrew, did you have a question?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for being here. My question is, given our current state of how hard corporate and business and the powers that be are trying to maintain their power by repealing rights, where do you see, how do you blend that with your saying this may be our biological imperative to be more democratic? What's the pathway from here to there in your view?
Well, every society, and one of the better books on this was actually published in 1968 or 69 by Peter Farb. It was called Man's Rise to Civilization. And what he did is he documented 38 Native communities in the United States at first contact. At the very, you know, he got the reports from the people, literally the very first time they had contact with these Native American communities. And all of them, or virtually, well, no, all of them had internal systems to deal with people who tried to acquire power. And, it's just fascinating that these societies viewed the accumulation of wealth and the accumulation of power as a mental illness, essentially. And they would heavily ostracize people that they caught doing this kind of thing. And in some cases, even banish them from the community, which, depending on where you're located, could be a death sentence because, in some of the more remote parts, like among the Shoshone, that would have been a death sentence, in the deserts of Nevada. So what we're seeing here is something that is inconsistent with human nature. It's inconsistent with nature itself. By the way, just to that point, when Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, he said, it's a life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and he said this was the intention of nature's God. And when he wrote that, John Adams did the first edit on the Declaration, and he scratched out nature's God and put in the Christian God. And then Jefferson got it back after Adams and Franklin had a look at it, and he scratched out the Christian God and put back nature's God, which is still in it's to this day, the Declaration of Independence is nature's God, because they really believed that this was the natural way of life that they were observing in these other Native communities that did not include dictatorial, hierarchical political systems, and did not include people accumulating great wealth. So, you're absolutely right. This is a major crisis for our democracy, for our republic. And, the massive accumulation of wealth. We've got levels of wealth that we have literally never seen relative to the wealth of the average population in the history of the United States. And we had some pretty substantial accumulations of wealth from the 1830s to the 1860s, particularly in New York and down in the South. But this is way beyond that. We are in territory that the United States has never seen before. So I think that produces its own natural pushback, And I agree with Neil Howe, who wrote The Fourth Turning Is Here, that we have kind of run through the and Stanley Turchin, or Peter Turchin, I think it's Peter, maybe it's Stanley, whatever, the guy who writes about the 40-year cycles, Howe writes about 80-year cycles, that we've kind of burned through 40 years of Reaganomics. And in fact, I wrote about this in my last book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism, How Reaganomics Gutted the American Middle Class. I think people have figured out that it didn't work, and that having all this wealth concentrated in a small number of hands, the billionaires in America made over $800 billion just in the first 6 months of this year, and whereas, the bottom 90% made some, but, nothing close to that. I think this is a last gasp. I really do. Now, I realize the Supreme Court in 76 and 78 in the Buckley decision and in the Bilotti decision ruled that that money is the same thing as and corporations are persons, and that billionaires have money, that all of us do. And then they tripled down on that in with Citizens United in 2010, and that has led to not only the corruption of politics, all across the country, particularly in the GOP, but also you see some Democrats like Joe Manchin, and Kyrsten Sinema are on the take. But they're, more the exception than the rule. But it's also, they also legalize bribery of themselves. And now we discover that Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito have been on the take for years, as was Scalia and Rehnquist. So I think this is an anomaly, Andrew. I think that we're starting to see a major pushback. You're seeing it with the rise of the union movements. You're seeing it with young people protesting this. I think the Occupy movement was the early warning signal, as it were, for the morbidly rich in this country. And I believe it's just a matter of time before we get a significant enough Democratic majority at the federal level that we can at least have reasonable taxation. Right now, the average billionaire in America pays 3.4% as income taxes. I'm guessing you pay more than 3.4%. I know I do, because we're not billionaires and we don't have access to all those loopholes that they literally paid legislators to put into the tax code. So I have a feeling we're coming to the end of that.
Well, at the end of your book, you do talk about... you state that revitalizing democracy in America won't be easy, but it is definitely worth the effort. Why?
Well, because democracy works. If you want to have a stable country, if you want to have a stable political system, you want as much democracy as you can get. And, of course, the Republicans don't want a stable democracy or a stable political system. They want oligarchy. They want a political system and an economic system in this country that basically only benefits the truly wealthy, the morbidly rich, and which is why they've been pushing so hard for oligarchy now for 40 years. And the oligarchy is usually a transitional political system. It almost always does one of two things. It either disintegrates in upon itself, or it turns into full-out fascism, basically, a dictatorial regime. You can see this in Russia. You can see it in Hungary. And I think we're seeing the early stages of it here in the United States. Jimmy Carter on my program 7 years ago said that because of Citizens United, America is no longer a democracy. It is an oligarchy. And I think that, he was largely right. But like I said, oligarchies typically they don't last more than two generations if you look throughout history. And so that's the choice. As our oligarchy begins to disintegrate, one of two things is going to happen. We're either going to flip fascist and the Republicans are going to take control, or we're going to become more small-d democratic and, power is going to revert to the people. And the Democrats will be in control.
You also talk about an agenda for democracy, what we could do about that, the kinds of things that we need to make sure happen. What are some of those?
Most of those were derived from the idea that if we believe that democracy is the right thing, and I think I build a strong case for that in the book, then the things that more than half of Americans want right now, we probably should be doing. And so, you know, a lot of the things, there's 20 some odd things in that fourth part of the book, you know, the kind of agenda for democracy. But most of them are things that poll way above 50%, you know, strengthening Social Security, making, you know, providing Medicare for all, or having a national health care system that is inexpensive and covers everybody, lowering the cost of pharmaceuticals, getting giant corporations and foreign buyers out of the residential housing market, and thus lowering rents and home costs. Breaking up monopolies. You know, I mean, I don't have the book in front of me, so
that's okay. I've got a list.
Okay.
Some of them are keep church and state separate. Make voting a right instead of a privilege. It can go on. The 20 that you have, instant runoff voting to make minority parties viable, abolish electoral college, you know, obviously busting up the media conglomerates. As you said, probably 60%, if not more, of the country already supports this, and yet we don't have a Congress that implements it. Is that because, remember the Gillens and Page study that we really
2014.
Yeah, that we really don't have a Congress that represents the people.
Right, and that's because of the Supreme Court. That's because, you know, with Citizens United and Buckley and Bilotti, they legalized bribery. And so now you've got, you know, right-wing billionaires and giant corporations that buy politicians. It's the very best investment you can make. You know, you got the average, like I said, the average billionaire in America is paying 3.4% in income taxes. That is not an accident. That's the result of their being able to buy politicians, that having been legalized by the Supreme Court, and then them actually doing it. So, you know, that's probably the first thing we need to do. And we would have taken a big bite out of that with the For the People Act last year, which passed the House of Representatives and had 51 votes in the Senate with Kamala Harris. But the Republican filibuster, Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin refused to go along with breaking the Republican filibuster or drilling a hole through it. And therefore, the For the People Act, which would have really strengthened our democracy and would have reduced dramatically the impact of Citizens United, did not pass. And that has to be one of the very first things. It has to be at the top of our agenda if we acquire a sufficient majority in the 2024 elections for January 2025.
Well, we certainly need to take the Senate in 2024 as well. You know, one of the things that I just heard Stuart Stevens say this morning, who was a Republican strategist, and he's talking about the oligarchs and also Donald Trump, in that they're not running for the Constitution and they're not running for the rule of law.
Yeah, I think that that's an honest evaluation that the Republicans are what they've decided is that, you know, the best way to get people motivated to vote is to engender hate, and the best way to win elections is to make it really, really difficult for Democratic voters, for people voting in areas that are heavily Democratic, to vote. And so you end up with 10-hour lines in black and student neighborhoods. You know, the Supreme Court in 2018 legalized the secretaries of state in the red states just randomly throwing people off the voting rolls in blue cities. It's not randomly. They have to send them a postcard, you know, which mm-hmm. looks like junk mail.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just, you know, Brian Kemp threw over 100,000 people off the voting rolls just before he won against Stacey Abrams with a 50,000 vote margin. You know, it's like, this is not right. And the For the People Act would have taken care of all that. But, you know, like I said, we got shafted by these two renegade Democrats,
yes.
Sadly.
Well, to respect your 30 minutes, I wanted to thank you very much, Tom, for coming back to Be Bold America on KSQD. And for, I think, your ninth book, The Hidden History of American Democracy, you have to have a round number of 10 in the series. It just, you know, my high sense of order needs that.
Okay. Well, we're talking to my publisher about that right now.
Thank you, Tom. You may listen to his radio show. Thank you. You may listen to his radio show weekdays on the Pacifica Radio Network, Sirius XM, and right here on KSQD. Learn more about Tom Hartman at tomhartman.com, thehartmanreport.com, or reach him on Twitter at tom_Hartman. And he's also on substack.com. So thank you again, Tom, very much for your time.
Thanks, Jill, and Andrew, too. Thank you so much for joining me.
And next, we'll be right back in 2 minutes to speak with Andrew Goldenkranz, chair of the Santa Cruz County Democratic Party, after this two-minute Jim Hightower commentary titled, "The Supreme Court, a Nest of Clueless, Overprivileged Elites." I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Here's an embarrassing turn of events. The six right-wing ideologues now controlling the Supreme Court recently decreed that helping some students get into college through affirmative action programs is henceforth unconstitutional. This is somewhere between clueless and cynical, since at least five of these six aloof supremes got into colleges and law schools through higher education's most entrenched channel of affirmative action, family affluence, and elite connections. America's higher ed establishment has long promoted a self-serving conceit that entrance to its campuses is based on meritocracy. Blatant racial and gender discrimination, however, put the lie to that, so schools adopted affirmative action policies to help rebalance the mix. The six supreme partisans killed this effort, replacing it with nothing. Meanwhile, our college system is becoming even more exclusive because of a deeply ingrained institutional bias that deliberately shuts out millions of the best and brightest, no matter their race, gender, or religion. That bias is economic class. From prestigious private schools to most big-name state universities, recruitment and admission procedures overwhelmingly favor those families privileged to have money and social standing. No matter how smart or promising working class and poor students are, they're largely left out. New York Times columnist David Linhart reports that this class divide is sharp, with some colleges enrolling more undergraduates from the wealthiest 1% of families than from all the families in the bottom 60%. These far-right political justices, blind to the special privileges they've been given in life, are imperiously negating our people's hard-won progress toward, well, toward justice for all. This is Jim Hightower saying all six need to be replaced, not merely with better judges, but with better human beings. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
If you're just joining us, for the first half hour of the program, we were speaking with Tom Hartman on his new book, The Hidden History of American Democracy. Now we are very fortunate to have Andrew Goldenkranz for the next half hour. Andrew's been a public educator for 35 years and since 2020 has been chair of the Santa Cruz County Democratic Party, representing 112,000 local Democrats. As part of his career in education, he conducted research at the American Museum of Natural History and developed public health curriculum at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Andrew's political organizing comes from his career experience and personal background and is driven to fight for a seat at the table for those who historically have not had one. Thank you, Andrew, for waiting and listening to Tom discuss the history of our American democracy. Welcome to Be Bold America. It's your first time.
Thank you, Jill. It's good to be here, and what a treat to share the air with Tom and Jim Hightower. Good to be here.
Well, I'm delighted that you could make it and be here. You listened to Tom that first half hour. What struck you most about listening to him?
Well, I think he makes a pretty clear case about the history of the attempts to concentrate power. And I think a lot of the rules and decisions that he cites are devices that people in power use to maintain their power and deny other people power. And so I was particularly struck by his reference to the data around a 60-year arc or an 80-year arc. I've seen the same thing from Robert Putnam, who wrote a great book called The Upswing. Talks about the same thing. And he says we are possibly in the stage of bottoming out, and we can look forward to potentially things getting better as we move forward.
Wahoo! I hope they're right.
But it will take some work. Let me add one more thing.
Go ahead,
you know,
of course.
A lot of us are familiar with the term that I don't think Dr. King originated, but it's associated with him when he says the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I would say yes and, but it doesn't bend itself. It has to be bent through organizing and by applying human energy.
Oh, very good. I like that. And also, you know, I played the Jim Hightower about the Supreme Court. What are your thoughts about today's Supreme Court? What are we going to do?
What can we do?
Of course,
and I think combining what Tom said and what Jim Hightower said, it seems to me that the key is really in increasing the majority in the Senate and getting close to a filibuster-proof process. We had that for a little while back when President Obama was elected in 2008. We had 60 votes, and look what happened. We got major progress towards expanding health care. We got LGBT rights. We got, you know, enfranchised. And so that didn't happen by itself. That happened because there were 60 or almost 60 votes in the Senate, as well as a Democratic president. That's a big part of where our effort needs to be.
Well, I think the Supreme Court is a very challenging issue, and it's a domino effect from an individual person's vote to getting to the point where we can do something to expand or correct the Supreme Court or even impeach some of them. People talk about not their vote not being worth anything. Oh, I don't vote. Every vote counts. I'm just very worried about how the Supreme Court, what they're going to do in the meantime. What do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. The court is not showing any signs of changing their direction. And I think that with a Republican majority in the House, even a slim one, and a basically split Senate with a slight Democratic majority, impeachment's not really a viable option.
No. Continued
pressure for getting the same kind of ethics rules for Supreme Court members that exist for other members of the federal judiciary would be a baby step, but an important step in the right direction.
Well, they're shameless. It's amazing how shameless they can see and read the papers and hear the reports. They know that they have no ethics, and it doesn't seem to matter to them. Chief Justice Roberts, this is his court, and for some reason, he's perfectly happy to have their reputation destroyed.
Well, it was clear from his confirmation back during the George W. Bush administration that he was coming out of the business community. He did not have a background on the bench. He had a background as a corporate attorney, and that his main agenda was to support the development of corporate power. And he's been successful in doing that. I don't agree with it, but he has been true to his word. Let's put it that way.
Go ahead.
You know, one of the things you mentioned, and I want to talk about this process, that it's very easy, especially with the onslaught of social media, the momentum at the Supreme Court, all these different the inequality in the economy, it's so easy for people to disengage and say, I just can't anymore. I have to withdraw for my own mental health. And I totally get that emotion, but I can't stress strongly enough what a bad idea that is. Democracy works when people engage in the process. And I think we've seen that in a couple of key cases. I think that the country potentially is going to turn these next couple of years on things like abortion rights, where states are going, not only did the Supreme Court go in the wrong direction, but states are then trying to leapfrog each other to say who can go back the furthest in withdrawing people's rights. And the fact is people are not going to stand for it. So that's one example, but I think that's a way that people can engage. We've seen it in Georgia. We saw it in Pennsylvania last year. And we almost saw it in Wisconsin. That came really within about a handful of votes per precinct. So I think this is a place where people can engage in a way that that their participation can make a difference. I think that's what we all want. People want to be busy. They want to be informed, and they want to take actions that they think can matter. And I think there are some important ways that that can happen.
It's very important for people when they become overwhelmed, and I have to admit, I do too. I become overwhelmed, and it's very important for people to take care of themselves, to take a break from the news for a while, for a few days, or whatever it is. Go to nature, take a walk, reassess what they stand for and what their mission is, so that they can get inspired and go back into fighting for this democracy. Because I don't know if you were able to hear about what Trump said last night at a rally. Did you catch what he said?
I did. I heard the highlight reel.
Yes, because he basically said 2024 is our final battle, and put it in terms of that when he gets to be president, he will weaponize his government against his enemies, enlisting universities and professors and the media and people like you and me and Tom. And it was a 99-minute speech of darkness, another carnage speech like his presidential acceptance speech. And what was really frightening is his followers clapping and agreeing and cheering. And he would keep saying that they're taking my freedom away, and next they're going to be taking your freedom away. And, you know, with that kind of zealot outrage, they're definitely going to vote. So with the progressives and the Democrats and those who want to save democracy, and we do really have a very plain, simple, clear decision. One party is fighting for democracy, and one party is fighting for authoritarianism. And he is right. This is 2024 is our final battle. I just want to see democracy to win. Back to you, Andrew, after that rant.
I agree with you, and not... I say this not as a supporter of Mr. Trump, but that in some ways that's been the secret to his success all along, his political success, is when he speaks to fear and he speaks to hate, then in Tom Hartman started his talk today by talking about things that we understand from the natural world. One of the things that we learn from the natural world is that the fear, that portion of your brain, the fight or flight, that fear processing part of your brain is in the back of your brain, in the reptilian part of your brain, and it works about 100 times as fast as the front of your brain, where we make more proactive, thoughtful decisions. And so by attacking that, he is looking for that instantaneous emotional reaction. And he gets it. So there's clearly about a third of the country who are not going to get their minds changed. They are going to be Trump all the way down. And then there's about a third of the country that is opposed to that, opposed to him. And then there's about a third that are kind of in the middle that are going to get swung. We think that they will get that. We think that the potential is for swinging them on a variety of issues. Let me give you just a couple of them. I talked about women's reproductive health, which is super.
Andrew,
important.
Hold that thought, yep. Because I need to take another break. Hold that for a minute. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear this interview? A free subscription to Be Bold America's podcast is available at Apple, Google, Radio Public, Spotify, and many more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Join KSQD this evening at 6 for Tackling the Taboo Sunday Dinner. Mark Gardner welcomes Angel Rio Tutar, director of the UC Santa Cruz American Indian Resource Center, to discuss Native Americans on campus, and Shayna Burns looking at vertical gardens and food independence. That's this evening from 6 until 7 here on KSQD, 90.7 FM and KSQD.org.
If you're just joining us, we are now speaking with Andrew Goldenkrantz, chair of the Santa Cruz County Democratic Party, and the current, and we're talking about the current challenges facing democracy. Learn more about the Santa Cruz County Democratic Party by visiting cruzdemocrats.org. Okay, back to you, Andrew. What were you going to finish there? Andrew?
She gets turned.
Oh, there we go. Start over, Andrew. I think we had a little. Yeah, go ahead. Start over.
Better? Okay.
Yeah.
So I think there are a number of, there's a handful of issues where this race is going to get turned. It's pretty clear that on women's health, on women's reproductive health, that there is a substantial majority that is not in favor of taking these laws back to the pre-Roe conditions. So that's the first thing. Second thing is it's pretty clear that there are some people who are, who may be economically pretty conservative, but who are just not ready for a return to the chaos and the corruption that the Trump administration brought forward. And I think this is where President Biden, for all of his strengths and successes and all of his limitations, he promised kind of a return to normalcy and has largely delivered on that. You see that in the way that he's viewed around the world. You see that in the way Congress is starting to work in a bipartisan way a little bit more. And then the third thing is I think we have an effective infrastructure that we're part of, which is like here in your our broadcast area, this is a reliably pretty blue place, and it's easy to get complacent. But we mobilized over 100,000 postcards to Georgia and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin last year for the Senate races and won two of those three. And so I think remembering that in 2024, it's not one national race. It's 50 races, one state at a time. And that's where the personal connections are going to work. It's not going to be the emails. It's not going to be the texts that we get all the time. It's not even going to be the TV advertising. It's going to be the personal connections. So what we did, we've been doing this since 2018, is we do handwritten postcards to either new voters or people who are not, who are intermittent voters in those swing states, and talk about the importance of voting and the stakes of things that are going to be on the ballot. And our data shows that we increased the turnout by 8% as a result of our efforts.
Oh, excellent.
So
that's a lot.
We've got, you know, again, it's not like one thing is going to be a magic wand, but we think that's an example of the kind of work that is going to be really important.
Well, I understand that they're probably mostly in our swing states, but about 17 House of Representatives seats that are on very fine Republican margins. There's 17 more Republicans in Congress right now. And I think that if that kind of strategy is used towards those 17 on the edge, currently held Republican congressional seats, they could be swung over to Democratic seats and then really get to maybe a strong amount of, majority or even a supermajority in the Congress. Is that your understanding, too?
Yeah, I think the House is ripe for flipping back to Democratic majority. And I think part of that is the real self-destructive last 6 months that we've seen from Speaker McCarthy and his Republican majority is they just have not, they haven't delivered on anything meaningful. It's a little bit of a circus. As depressing as it is, I think we're going to see more of that between now and next fall. So I think, yeah, the House is there for the taking. But when it comes back to where we started the conversation about things like appointing judges, all of that, that's the Senate.
That's the Senate. That's right. We need to get enough people coming out to compensate for the gerrymandering that has happened in these swing states. It's an uphill battle, but one that we can win. Stuart Stevens, and again to say he was a Republican strategist, also said that there needs to be zero daylight between Democrats in support of Biden. And what worries me, and I want to get your thoughts on, is what RFK Jr. is doing and what the New Labels organization is doing, because both of them can take away from the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party. And if we need zero daylight, and that's a Republican strategist telling us that, because he said, really, Biden won with just a little over 40,000 votes because of the Electoral College. So he may have gotten 7 million more Democratic votes, but with the Electoral College, he only won by 40,000-something votes. So it's really closer than we think. And he said no labels is incredibly dangerous. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, the no labels thing is a real threat. I think Manchin, on the one hand, Senator Manchin is not electable. I don't think that America is ready to support a coal millionaire who has worked to slow down, you know, work on climate change and has fought expansion of healthcare. So I don't think that he's just got the resume to do it. But
I was talking about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. too. I mean, that's
So Kennedy, that's a completely different situation. So Manchin, I don't think himself is a winning formula. But the idea of running a moderate who's going to take some Republican votes and take
that's right.
Votes.
Manchin is who No Labels is putting up, correct? I'm sorry.
That's Lambeau. Yeah, Labels, right?
Right.
And the Kennedy stuff. Look, I've been paying attention to RFK Jr. because of my work in public health, where his extreme anti-vaccination policies are really what brought him prominence. His prior history as an environmental reformer, as an environmental lawyer, is laudable, but his recent forays into anti-vaccine stuff, and he's totally sponsored by like Steve Bannon, and you know, people really on the kind of Newsmax side of the Republican spectrum,
side of the Republican spectrum. Yes.
Yeah, and I'll say this as a Jewish American, that he has engaged in some really harsh commentary. He made a reference yesterday to ethnic targeting of COVID, and he's used Holocaust references.
Yes, I saw that.
They're just really put him outside like a normal conversation in a way that for me is completely unacceptable. But in Santa Cruz, it's going to be interesting because there's going to be a small but noisy portion of kind of the libertarian left, like people who distrust government and distrust big institutions, and then people on the libertarian right who are just looking to destabilize the whole process. So it's going to be an interesting confluence in Santa Cruz. Again, not enough to win, but maybe enough to rock the boat a little bit. But we got to watch out for that.
Well, in the last few minutes, do you have any ideas on what we could keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to work towards a thriving democracy? Our future depends on it.
Well, we have, so there's a couple things in play. The first is, as I mentioned, there are a number of either through the Democratic Party or on a nonpartisan basis for people who prefer to do that, these phone banks and postcarding campaigns into the swing states. So Swing Left does a great job. We also work with a group called Reclaim Our Vote, which focuses on majority communities of color, usually in the South. And that's been loosely, that was kind of an affiliate of the Stacey Abrams Fair Fight operation. So Reclaim Our Vote has done some great work around here. Indivisible has done some really good work. So there are different kinds of new networks that are really helpful. The second is to participate in organizing the unorganized. So whether it's, for example, like around here, there has been a lot of activity, and I think they totally deserve our support when we see organizing of Starbucks workers, of the fast food campaigns. In this case, watching what's going on with the Teamsters and UPS, who were fighting for the right to have air-conditioned trucks so that when they're driving in 110-degree weather.
Oh, what happened? I don't hear him. Did you plug in my headset? Oh, dear. I just lost him. I'm sorry, folks, here. Well, one of the things that I was going to say to Andrew is that the, you know, the Donald Trump, the third of the country, they want to divide, distrust, delay, and demonize. And I was thinking that we need to unite, be trustworthy, act now, and we're all in this country together. And I think I'm changing headset. Hold on. Andrew, are you there? No, I don't hear him on your headset either. We don't know what happened. I'm sorry, listeners. Here, let me get back to my headset because it still is empty. Okay, well, let's get... So I'm going to thank Andrew for being our bold guest today and a bold leader in Santa Cruz County. Andrew does invaluable work towards saving our democracy. Thank you for the gift of your time while on vacation. What's up next on Be Bold America? Join us Sunday, July 31st at 5 p.m. when our topic will be, Are You Being Gaslighted? What Are the Telltale Signs? We will be speaking with Dr. Robin Stern, a licensed psychoanalyst and co-founder and associate director for Yale University Center for Emotional Intelligence. In 2007, Dr. Robin Stern coined the phrase gaslight effect to explain the long-term effects of repeated gaslighting, an insidious and sometimes covert form of emotional abuse in which a gaslighter undermines and controls another person by deflecting, twisting, and denying their reality. In every case, gaslighting leaves you constantly second-guessing yourself, unable to make simple decisions, and destabilized from the constant reality shifts. Dr. Stern is the author of The Gaslight Effect, How to Spot and Survive the Hidden Manipulation Others Use to Control Your Life. And now she's completed the Gaslight Effect Recovery Guide that helps you turn off the gas. In addition, she is the host of the Gaslight Effect podcast. Don't miss, Are You Being Gaslighted? What Are the Telltale Signs? On Sunday, July 31st at 5 p.m. when Dr. Stern will offer invaluable insights into the dynamics of gaslighting and the impact on our emotional and national well-being. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer and Eliza James, to our program director, Howard Feldstein, and again to our bold and always impressive guest, Tom Hartman. Please visit tomhartman.com, hartmanreport.com, and you may contact him at tom_hartman on Twitter. And another big thank you to Andrew Goldenkrantz, chair of the Santa Cruz County Democratic Party. Visit cruzdemocrats.org. You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Tackling the Taboo Sunday Dinner with Mark Gardner. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.